for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Washington Post recently reported that states have passed more abortion regulations since 2000 than they did throughout the 1990s. And in the last 5 years, none of those laws have expanded access to abortion. Here to talk about state action on abortion and the future of Roe v. Wade, Marcia Greenberger of the National Women's Law Center, Marjorie Dannenfelser of the Susan B. Anthony List, Joan Biskupic of Reuters, and Sarah Cliff of The Washington Post. I do invite you all to be part of the program. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Joan Biskupic, I'll start with you. It's been 40 years since Roe v. Wade. Where does the public stand now?
It's so interesting that you stress the 40 years because the country feels as divided today as it was several decades ago on the abortion issue. It was 40 years ago in January where the Supreme Court ruled that there was a fundamental right for a woman to end a pregnancy, and that decision made abortion legal nationwide. The reason you care about it today is there's this issue over, did it preempt state action at the time? Did it provide a rallying point, as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has said, to the anti-abortion movement? People were very divided about abortion in those early years. And even today, as recently as, you know, just a month ago, our polls showed that people are still very split about abortion. About 47% said that it should be legal in most or all cases, and about 42% said it should be illegal in most or all cases. But yet the country is living with that decision.
Yes.
The country's living with it. It's just that you see these pockets of activity out there, and it comes into play when we have another politically charged, religiously influenced issue as same-sex marriage, as we saw last month.
Sarah Cliff, give us the lay of the land. What are we seeing at the state level?
Right. The last 2 years have really been kind of a sea change in abortion policy. In 2011, we saw states pass 92 restrictions on abortion. That was the most that's ever been seen since the Guttmacher Institute started tracking this issue a few decades ago. And it really, some of them were in response to the president's health care law, which kind of brought the abortion debate front and center, the issue of whether insurance plans should cover abortion. And you also saw Republicans take control of a lot of state houses where these laws are being passed rather than the federal level. So the two of those factors combined together really seem to have energized state houses to take action on restricting abortion. And then you kind of saw a bit of a lull in 2012. State legislatures tend to back away from abortion in election years. But now in 2013, you've seen some laws that are more aggressive than anything on the books, banning abortion as early as 12 weeks and then as early as 6 weeks in North Dakota. So 2013 is shaping up to be another year that could really change the landscape again on abortion policy.
Marcia Greenberger, what's your reaction to these laws? To what extent do they actually restrict the ability of women to get an abortion?
If they hold up and can pass court scrutiny, which is a very big if, because they are direct challenges to Roe v. Wade, they would have dramatic restrictive implications. They would shut down clinics statewide in a number of states. They would ban abortion so early that it's often it could be 6 weeks and before a woman even knows she's pregnant. They really would, through a combination of laws and approaches, make abortion, if these were adopted in each state nationwide, it would mean the end of the availability of abortion, except possibly in the cases of rape and incest, but that's not an exception in all of these laws, and also truly if the life of the mother was at stake. That's and the very narrow exceptions.
Marjorie Dent and Feltzer, why do you think the pro-life movement has had such success at state level?
Well, I think within the context of the years since Roe, since we're talking about 40 years, what happened during that in that decision was a striking down of every state law that restricted abortion. And so it created a simmering movement right away. Blackmun didn't even predict it. He thought maybe it was going to be a problem. Berger said, yes, this is going to be a huge problem. And in fact, it was, because consensus measures were also struck down. So over these 40 years, there's been quite a number of arguments about, are there stages in pregnancy where there should be a restriction? 39 bills have actually been passed recently that do restrict at some point. There are also restrictions of taxpayer funding of abortion and all that. But what happened during that time, and I think we're seeing now, and it's something that I think it is a good point of conversation here, is that the sonograms and the being able to view the unborn child has created a positive thing for the pro-life movement and has created a difficulty for the pro-choice movement. So now it's both and rather than either or. And coming to some consensus will create more civility when we talk about the abortion issue from here on out. I think it's a good thing that these things are happening.
Marjorie Dentenfeldzer, she's president of the Susan B. Anthony List, the organization helps elect candidates, pursues policies that will reduce and ultimately end abortion. Marcia Greenberger, she's co-president of the National Women's Law Center. The center works to protect access to abortion services and abortion rights. Joan Biskupic, she is legal affairs editor for Reuters. She's written biographies of Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, and Sarah Cliff. She's health policy reporter for The Washington Post. We will open the phones in just a few moments. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing from you. Marjorie, is there any divide within the pro-life movement about just how aggressive states should be?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that, because I think right now there is in particular heightened discussion about that. What I have found is that the biggest demographic that is out there that has turned more pro-life now are youth. That's the 18 to 34. 59% say it should be legal, illegal in most or all cases. That tends to be the group, because that's the nature of youth, I think, to be a whole lot stronger on personhood or heartbeat bills, which is about six weeks or so. That's the group that really seemed to congeal around the earlier ones. Our organization has generally taken an approach where we want to pass the laws that can quickly pass now. And so we have promoted eliminating taxpayer funding of abortion, restricting abortion after the point that the child feels pain, sex selection abortions, things like that that have such an overwhelming consensus that that's where we begin. But we certainly, of course, embrace the what the young people are doing right now as well.
Sarah, tell us about Kansas and what they're about to do.
So Kansas just this week passed legislation that would define personhood as beginning at fertilization. And that looks similar to some other laws that states have considered in recent years. There was a very big debate about this in Mississippi a few years ago, whether they should rework their constitution to define personhood as beginning at conception. And the Kansas law is a bit different. This isn't an amendment to its constitution. So the effects of it are unlikely to be as sweeping as that Mississippi law. But it certainly makes, you know, a statement and is arguably, although I'd love to hear other folks on this, arguably the most success the personhood movement is having right now if this legislation is signed by the Governor Brownback, which is expected he will sign it. It will be the first time, from what I understand, that a state has passed one of these laws declaring personhood as beginning at conception.
Joan Biskupic.
Well, it's interesting. Let me just tell you what the law is right now with the Supreme Court, both with the Roe versus Wade decision 40 years ago, and then most strikingly with the Casey decision in 1992. The Supreme Court has said that abortion can be only in the most minimal ways regulated before the fetus reaches viability. And that's 22 to 24 weeks, essentially, 20 weeks. I mean, you know, it's a standard that because of evolving medicine, you know, might be a little different. But we're talking as much as 20 weeks. We're not talking 6 weeks. We're not talking at fertilization. So the measure that Sarah just referred to and the earlier measures from North Dakota and other states are a real affront to where the Supreme Court has been at in terms of the viability standard. If these were to be enforced and then challenged and survive scrutiny in lower courts, it would really tee it up for the Supreme Court. I frankly would be shocked if the Supreme Court would uphold these measures that say that once you can detect any kind of fetal heartbeat or, you know, frankly, fertilization that Sarah was just referring to, that they would stand, given where the Supreme Court has been.
Joan Biskupic, she's legal affairs editor for Reuters. Short break here. When we come back, we will talk about North Dakota, what's going on there, and take your calls. Stay with us. Talking in this hour about various state laws that have been enacted across the country restricting or indeed establishing that life begins at conception, thereby curtailing the rights of women to seek abortion. Here with me is Sarah Cliff of the Washington Post, Joan Biskupic of Reuters, Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, and Marcia Greenberger, co-president of the National Women's Law Center. Sarah, talk about what's happening in North Dakota. They have one abortion clinic in the state. I know you talked with the director. How concerned is she?
She, you know, it's an interesting mix. So what North Dakota passed a few weeks ago was a set of three laws. One of them limits abortion after, or outlaws abortion after a heartbeat can be detected, which they estimate is 6 weeks. There's another law that also requires an abortion clinic to have admitting privileges at a local hospital. And a third law that outlaws gender-selective abortions. the restriction at 6 weeks has gotten the most attention because it is the most restrictive abortion ban in the country at this point. But the director of the one clinic in North Dakota is actually more worried about the law regarding admitting privileges at hospitals. As Marcia was saying earlier, the clinic director there expects that the six-week law is not going to be upheld by the courts, that they are going to see this as a violation of Roe and not allow that to come into effect. The law about admitting privileges, that could end up standing. And if there's only two hospitals in Fargo, North Dakota, where they're located, they're worried if no hospital there gives them admitting privileges that they're not going to be able to perform abortions.
Because explain that to me. Some doctors actually fly in to perform abortions and then fly out again.
Right. At the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, they have three doctors and none of them live in North Dakota. They all fly in to perform abortions there. And so she's worried that these hospitals are not going to give admitting privileges to doctors that don't reside in the state, and that this essentially will be a roundabout way to close her clinic.
Marcia, how likely is it that these various laws would stand up in court and most especially the Supreme Court?
Well, I don't think that these extreme laws will stand up in the court as it is currently constituted. Of course, for a number of years until the Obama administration, there was a determined effort to put justices on the Supreme Court who had a record of opposing Roe v. Wade. And that became a very important selection criteria. When Roe v. Wade was decided, it was decided by a vote of 7-2. There was a strong consensus. And the underlying purpose of the reason that it was viewed as a fundamental constitutional right for women is because their health, their lives, is viewed as the ultimate personal decision and life-altering effect for women. Many of these laws have no protection for a woman's health. Most of them don't. They do not take into account any of the practical real-life circumstances that women have to face. And so they run square up against the basic point of protecting women's health that was the underpinning of Roe v. Wade. And one other very super quick point about these personhood amendments, because they talk about life beginning at conception, that, of course, rules out abortion, certainly with respect to rape and incest, too, in most of those cases, let alone the health of the woman. But also they take into their sweep contraception. And for many years, people thought, well, the compromise was there may be different views on abortion, but at least we should be able to all get behind contraception. Now there are attacks on contraception, and these personhood amendments would make illegal many common forms of contraception, too.
Marjorie Dannenfelter, do you see it that way?
Well, I don't see Roe that way, of course, though I did when I was pro-choice. I think what changed was my understanding, and I think a general understanding of Roe is coming to light now, and that is the country has moved to a both and in terms of the woman and the child, not either or. And I think that is a huge shift among youth. It's a shift among women. Gallup calls pro-life the new norm. And it's because of that recognition. Some of these extreme cases going on now where clinic regulations are not enforced, like in Pennsylvania with Kermit Gosnell, who's under trial for murder because of the delivery and then the just brutal execution of children. Now, that was circumventing the law. But the point of bringing that up is that more and more, the country is seeing that thing that we're talking about as another human being. So then we talk about two sets of rights, two sets of needs that we have to address. address Marcia's point, however, on the on contraception, you don't, contraception is before the baby. So, I mean, it is just a rule of common sense that you can't have an abortion if you don't have a child. So
you don't see any of these restrictions leading to perhaps a state going even further?
Not at all. I mean, I know where we are on that issue, on the issue of contraception. There is not a momentum in this country to address that, but there is tremendous momentum to come to some consensus on what we all believe is a civil society should do for women and unborn children. And we have it for that in abortion.
So you believe that Roe v. Wade lean too far in favor of the rights of women and not taking into account sufficiently?
I think even further. I think it was only the doctor's medical judgment. I mean, several legal scholars have said it's almost that the woman was sort of a B player in this because it was so centered on the physician and his judgment about medical, what was good practice. And it was very arbitrary. If you've read through, which you guys have, because you're legal scholars, have read through how the decision was made, it was very arbitrary. First, it was going to be only the first trimester. And then it extended into the second trimester that there could be no restrictions. And then after the third trimester, only for the life and health of the mother, which is also defined as psychological health and emotional health, size of family, all those things. So, yes, I clearly disagree with that, as the country does.
And Justice Ginsburg, you referred to earlier, made some comments last month to the effect that perhaps Roe v. Wade had come too soon and gone too far. Expand on that.
I will, and I just want to clarify two things. And Justice Ginsburg has made her comments dating back decades, but they need to be framed in a couple caveats. First of all, Roe v. Wade, as Marjorie accurately said, did have an emphasis more on the medical side. It was written by Harry Blackmun, an appointee of Richard Nixon, a Republican, but he had been general counsel of the Mayo Clinic, and he came to it with that sensibility. Subsequent abortion decisions, however, have very much put the emphasis on the woman's right, including in the Casey decision from 1992 that I referred to, and subsequent decisions have talked much more about the woman's right. And Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who left the court in January 2006, who was critical in terms of reinterpreting and clarifying abortion law by the Supreme Court, again stressed the burden on the woman. So I just wanted to get that out there in terms of where the court is at. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, very active women's rights advocate. That's how she made her name nationally, as someone who had founded the American Civil Liberties Women's Rights Project, very much of an abortion rights supporter, but coming at it in terms of equal rights between men and women. And what she believed and said early on was that Roe became an unnecessary flashpoint for the other side because it did come at a time when state legislatures were moving toward more permissive abortion laws. That's what she thought. Now, let me just say this, though, in terms of where she's at because of how her remarks have been used in the same-sex marriage context. She was never against abortion rights. She had sharp criticism for the rationale that the court majority had used and would have preferred a less stunning legal rationale, maybe more in terms of equal protection, the equal protection guarantee for women rather than this due process privacy rights. And then also, again, she felt that it had in some ways preempted state action. Her remarks have been brought to the forefront in the same-sex marriage context because people have felt that she could be exhibit A for maybe the court shouldn't move so fast on same-sex marriage. I don't think the two issues can be equated in the same way, although they could be very defining for the Supreme Court as a judicial institution. But I think given the kinds of passions that you're even hearing here today, 40 years after Roe, abortion is a much tougher emotional religious flashpoint, I believe, than same-sex marriage in some ways. And we've already seen polls showing so much more acceptance of same-sex unions and marriage in a way that we still don't see on some of the abortion things. So I don't think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself would believe that they can be equated in terms of the public sentiment that way.
Is it possible for me to just say something very quickly about the polling? because I think there have been a number of comments assuming that there is a very, very narrow division. And in fact, as is true with many polls, it depends on how the question is asked. So if the question is asked, would you want to see Roe v. Wade overturned? There's a very strong majority in opposed to seeing Roe v. Wade overturned. People will sometimes answer the question depending on how they feel personally about their own decision. But if the question is very clear about do you want to make the law prevent other women from making this personal decision themselves, then the answer is very different in the polls. And as to young people, we are seeing a lot of energy, and because there was a quiet assumption on the part of many young women that this was a right that was secure, that was one that was the Supreme Court had decided 40 years ago. My own organization, the National Women's Law Center, has a new project, an online project called This is Personal, and speaks to young women. We are overwhelmed by the response. So we are beginning to see a political movement that's very strong, both respect to abortion and contraception.
Marcia Greenberger, co-president of the National Women's Law Center, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Sarah, before we go to the phones, how likely is it that the Supreme Court will take up Roe again in the near or distant future?
Well, if I had a crystal ball, I could answer that a little more accurately. But from what I understand, there are a lot of people on both sides of the debate that do expect an abortion decision at the Supreme Court because of this wave of laws we've seen. I spoke to Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards, who says, you know, yes, I expect one of these to make its way up to the Supreme Court. And you see some from the other side. North Dakota's governor, when he signed the law that bans abortions at 6 weeks there, he said he recognized, you know, it might not survive a challenge, but he would like to challenge Roe as standing law. And so you see on both sides, you know, they don't agree on the issue, but there seems to be some consensus that this is likely heading towards a Supreme Court case, although I'd also defer to Joan, who knows the court better than I do.
Well, it's really tricky. You know, Marcia was talking about the court as it was constituted under Ronald Reagan and how that was a litmus test for him. It obviously wasn't a litmus test for Richard Nixon, since Richard Nixon's appointees supported the decision. You know, obviously the two new Obama appointees would vote for Roe. And right now, Anthony Kennedy, our key swing vote on this, has made clear that he does support Roe v. Wade, but he's 76. He'll turn 77 in July. Ruth Bader Ginsburg just turned 80. Who knows what's going to happen in the next couple of years? But I have always believed that there wasn't a legal or, frankly, political appetite to overturn Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
you never know.
You never know, and things change fast here.
All right. Marjorie, what about the Affordable Care Act? How are states using that to limit access to abortion?
Well, of course, we had that whole debate in 2010 over whether it would require federal funding of abortion or not. There was no statute put into the bill, and so there was an executive order, which doesn't, of course, have the weight of statute. And states get that. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Marcia, I believe that probably abortion rights organizations saw that as probably an open door, potentially, for it to be able to fund abortion since it's considered a health care right. And it certainly is happening right now in Washington State. Washington State is requiring that the exchanges there fund full abortion funding. So we're going back and saying, gee, I hate to be a mother and say I told you so. However, we did say if you didn't put it in the bill, it would be a problem. 21 states have said in their state exchanges that they will not fund abortion, but now they're having to re-up those laws because now they're needing to apply them to the federal exchanges as they move in. So that's where we are with that.
Sarah, the Virginia General Assembly took action.
Yes. So you've seen, you know, as Marjorie mentioned, a lot of states since the Affordable Care Act have taken up these kind of laws with great success. As you mentioned, 21 states have passed laws like these. Virginia is the most recent, where it is going to bar any of the plans sold on the exchange, these new marketplaces that will launch next year in 2014. So the plan sold there, and this is the only place that taxpayers who receive subsidies can go to buy insurance. The plan sold there will not cover abortion. And that's kind of, it's been a new law that you've seen showing up across the country ever since the Affordable Care Act became law.
Just by way of clarification, before the Affordable Care Act, the basic principle had been most insurance companies did cover abortion. Most private insurance companies simply had general provisions that covered medical procedures according to physicians' judgments, and abortion wasn't excluded. So what we're talking about here is changing circumstances.
Marcia Greenberg, co-president of the National Women's Law Center, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, it's your turn to be part of the conversation. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at thescanfoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Why being a giver as opposed to a taker is the best way to achieve career success. The case for helping others on the road to the top. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Ready to open the phones as we discuss what states are doing on the issue of abortion. Let's go to Sharon in South Bend, Indiana. Good morning.
Hi there. This is more of a comment and a little story than a question, but I come from the days, I'm 70, of the storefront abortions. Mm. Women were dying. They had no place to go but for illegal abortions. And my parents, who were fundamentalist Christians, sent me out of the country for an abortion. I later learned, when we started, the girls in my church started talking, that others were doing the same thing. I feel that our country is going backwards rather than forwards. And I see young women again dying from illegal abortions because they will not be able to afford to leave the country to have one. And that's really my comment. And I did want to say one more thing. I saw a woman on public television maybe 10 years ago, a religious woman, saying She said that once they took care of abortion, they were going to go after contraception.
All right. Thanks for your call. I wonder how you react to that, Marjorie, in terms of the number of women who we know died of back alley abortions, and those who had to leave the state. What do you say to them?
Well, two things. One is just the obvious, that it's an unbearable tragedy. There's a crisis. There's a moment. I mean, this is why I was very pro-choice. I would have had one in a minute without even worrying about what might be going on to that thing that we're talking about. At that point in time, there were not the over 3,000 pregnancy care centers in the country that there are now. And yet there are now, because there is a really, if you want to just be Pollyannish and just be real, there is really love at the center of this movement. It is love for the mother and the child. And there is a moment when she has great need, and there is a moment for people to speak for what this thing is that we've been talking about, that we keep looking at on sonograms or see, you know, pictured in other. There, it is a moment to serve both, and that is actually a returning. It's not, if we're truly going backward, then we're returning to our feminist roots, the suffragists who truly believed that you don't treat children as property to be disposed of in the way that women were treated as property.
Marcia Greenberger.
Well, you know, I'm struck by several things. First of all, the emphasis in the courts, the underlying principle for Roe v. Wade and abortion rights is women's health and their own ability to protect their own health, their own lives. In this country, we are 47th in maternal mortality, 47th, an unacceptable figure. None of these restrictions have exceptions to protect women's health, including their future fertility. To me, one of the cruelest things of all, in the case of a woman who wants a pregnancy, but that is a deeply, deeply flawed pregnancy, and they would restrict her ability to terminate it at the cost of her ability to have future children.
All right, let's
and
go.
If I could also, for Diane, just say the laws being passed right now also would make IUDs illegal, because many now say they operate after fertility.
All right, to Chris in St. Joseph, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. The question that I had is, the thought of this issue eventually reaching the Supreme Court again, currently there are parties that are asking the Supreme Court to redefine marriage as it had been known for thousands of years, and certainly as it was known at the time of Roe versus Wade. What would be to stop that same court from redefining person different than it has in, for instance, Casey or Roe? 40 years ago, and saying, hey, we're going to throw this out in the same way that Lawrence versus Texas basically abandoned the reasoning of Bowers versus Hardwick.
All right, Joan.
Yeah, there are two separate issues, of course, but you're right that they both play into sort of the politically charged, you know, religiously influenced issues that people feel a lot at stake in, and that there, much is happening out in a very dramatic way in the political forum. I think that a 40-year decision, Roe versus Wade, there'd be a lot of arguments to keep it where it's at, just because it's been 40 years. Now, the two other decisions that the caller referred to in terms of rights for gay men and lesbians, they weren't around as long, and they were very divisive among the justices. They were 5-4 decisions. They weren't the 7-2. It just came in a different way. I'll just address the sodomy one that he referred to, Lawrence v. Texas, which in 2003, the court reversed earlier decisions that said that states could outlaw intimate relations between adults, consenting adults. Again, it's even though they are both really hot social issues, they come to people in a different way. And the awareness that the justices have themselves have observed and that the nation has observed in terms of the rights of gay men and lesbians is much different today. And I think that's what leads to that kind of change. I also would say, though, having sat through those oral arguments in the same-sex marriage cases at the end of March, I don't see them taking a dramatic step in those. I think that what we're going to likely see is not a nationwide right to same-sex marriage at this time. I do think the justices will follow what lower courts have done, though, and said once a state does allow same-sex marriage, the federal government has to give those people the same rights that the federal government gives heterosexual couples.
To North Carolina. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning. This is a wonderful program. Thanks, Diane, for having it. Actually, I have to say hello to Marjorie. We grew up together, but we're on polar opposites of this issue. And I have a quick
Who did you say you are? Don't tell any stories.
We graduated together.
I didn't hear your name.
All right. His name is Derek. Let's move on.
Let's move on. Anyway, I have a quick comment and a question. And you know, sometimes the dire use of hyperbole in the way this issue is constructed, and a lot of the times in the way that they're talking about what the polls are saying, you begin to believe that they've been kind of ginned up. And so I'm wanting to know, what is the people's ultimate goal? Because why do they need to define life and to infringe on somebody else's personal choice and at the same time attack Planned Parenthood and all the other institutions that Planned Parenthood actually not only helps women and women's and sexual health, but helps men. And so many of the children that may be born in an unwanted situation, if they wind up as part of either the penal system or remain in poverty, that's really not a pro-life view. These are people who wind up suffering long-term.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Derek, I think if we were talking about chocolate or vanilla ice cream, none of us would be having this conversation right now. The choice involves a choice between two human beings. And we say, don't make a choice between the two. Let's embrace the two. Let's make room for those. Even if some people decide that a person's life is not worth living, the child usually themselves is pretty grateful for their life. I've got one of those, and she changed all of our lives. And many people would have said made a different choice, not even knowing. So I think it's a dangerous place to be. It was made by Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, to say that there are people who are human weeds. I don't think any of us want to be in a situation like that. But I think the specific question was about the goal. I would say what I wake up thinking about and driving my motivation all the time is trying to help forge a consensus and make sure that consensus is enacted into law that reflects where we are right now. Actually, the consensus is already there. 60, 70, 80% issues on taxpayer funding of abortion, late-term abortions after viability, a whole host of and sex-selective abortions. There are just so many that we have a consensus on. And if we could come to some consensus, then perhaps the error of Roe being so dramatic could be partially corrected. We could start to move gradually toward it rather than having really no consensus in the law. The marches will continue, until we have gotten to some place where maybe neither side is absolutely happy, but most people feel we've gotten to an important accommodation.
Marcia.
Yeah, I'm a little confused because I do think this idea of driving towards consensus, I don't see a consensus when the right of a woman to be able to terminate a pregnancy is being so frontally challenged as it is right now. And Marjorie, as I understand it, those are bills and laws that you support. So I want to go back again and say, with respect to women's health there and criminalizing women, which is a part of what comes with something like these personhood amendments, doctors could be put in jail for performing abortions, women put in jail for what is viewed as killing now a person. Those are real live laws that are on the books in states right now that haven't been enforced because of Roe. We even have a legislator in New Mexico who has introduced a bill that would criminalize a woman who was a victim of rape terminating her pregnancy because it would interfere with the evidence of the rape. And that is an actual bill that has been introduced. So there, the idea of finding consensus when these are the fundamental attacks, regardless of woman's health, regardless of the viability of the fetus, no abortion after 6 weeks, closing down clinics like Planned Parenthood that are so safe and provide health, basic health care services for women. These are attacking where we have had a consensus in the country.
Here's an email from Lisa, who says, my mother was a nurse in the 1950s. She said she never saw a single woman who came in with injuries from back alley abortions survive. The older nurses would often say the poor women got what they deserved, but rich women were allowed procedures in the hospital that ended pregnancies, but being pregnant was never mentioned. They were said to deserve a second chance. Total hypocrisy. This is more an issue of thousands of women dying because outlawing abortions doesn't stop abortions from being done. Marjorie.
Again, that's a different time. There is a lot of mercy at the heart of this movement and a lot of love. People who have changed their minds, people who understand the suffering of women and also understand that there is a new person to be loved and protected and perhaps allow another family to take care of. Now, at this point in time, you cannot get, unless you are very wealthy, you cannot adopt a child in the face of all sorts of infertility. So the poverty that we as a nation have, that all these children just go down the sink instead of having a loving family is something to be mourned.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Brandy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, a longtime listener and big-time fan.
Thank you.
Question to the panel is I'm calling from Texas, which is a low-tax, low-service state. When we go and talk about pro-life and outlawing all abortions, we're talking about inundating a system that's already flooded with children, because I'm also a foster parent. These children are going to be on welfare. They're going to be in foster care. And I've seen the damage that foster care does to children. And I am lucky that I'm going to be adopting these children soon, but not all of these children end up like that. So what is their way of viewing this? What is their, how are they going to fix that in places like Texas where we don't want to spend money to help these children on welfare?
Sarah, first talk about the laws in Texas.
Right. Texas has really proven to be one of the most aggressive states in limiting Planned Parenthood's funding. We saw a debate at the national level that really bubbled up in 2011 in a way it hadn't ever before over whether the federal government should spend money on Planned Parenthood. And I would add the federal government does not fund abortions at Planned Parenthood, but they do fund other services such as cervical cancer screenings or breast exams, things such as that. And there was, you know, debate about, you know, while that funding isn't going to abortion, should the federal government be sending money for other services at what is the country's largest abortion provider? And, you know, that laws to defund Planned Parenthood, they didn't pass here in Washington. Those wouldn't be something we'd expect President Obama to sign. But in state legislatures, states that have decided, you know, we don't want to fund Planned Parenthood anymore. And Texas passed a law recently, I believe it was last year or the year before, outlawing funding for funding through its family planning programs at abortion providers.
All right. So, Marjorie, talk about her primary question. Who's going to take care of these presumably unwanted, unparented children?
Well, I think let's back up a little bit. The way our country and the women of this country and good people have responded to the most vulnerable in our society has not been is not typical of reflective of her comments. I think we're a lot more generous nation. I think most people don't say those sorts of things out loud. I think it's a very difficult place to put yourself in to say that there are people worthy and not worthy. And
I didn't hear that.
Well, maybe, okay, well, let me, then somebody in a vulnerable, she might not be the same, she might see that there's another person in a vulnerable position that she would like to help because she's obviously generous in her own life in terms of helping foster children. But those foster children in every household are valuable, are have rights that should be acknowledged.
But how many are taken into homes and cared for? And how many end up in institutions?
If pregnancy centers were anywhere close to getting the support that Planned Parenthood does, which is $1 million a day from the taxpayer, then we'd be in a much better situation to have adoptions where this tragedy wouldn't continue to occur.
Sarah, in the absence of Supreme Court ruling, are we likely to see more states enacting more restrictive laws?
I think of the past few years, the experience we've seen, that yes, we'll definitely see more restrictions.
Sarah Klipp of The Washington Post, Joan Biskupic of Reuters, Marjorie Dantenfelter of the Susan B. Anthony List, Marcia Greenberger of the National Women's Law Center. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Novo Nordisk.